Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hi there. I'm Rund Abdelfattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. If you've been trying to cut back on drinking this month, here's another good reason. Even a little bit of alcohol can harm your health. And more than one glass of red wine a night qualifies as excessive drinking if you're a woman. But what's the best way to reduce or eliminate what's become for many a way to reduce stress, deal with pandemic changes, or ease social interactions? Dry January, or taking the first month of the year off drinking, is a popular way to reset our relationships with alcohol. So if you've been doing it, we want to hear from you. How's it going? Forum is next. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Studies from decades ago suggested that light to moderate drinking could be good for you, like a glass of red wine a night was good for your heart. And those findings stuck around in the minds of Americans and have even guided policy. But recent studies find that any amount of alcohol can have negative impacts. Dana G. Smith is health and science writer for the New York Times, and her recent piece is called Even a Little Alcohol Can Harm Your Health. Dana, welcome to Forum.
Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you. So first, what do you mean by a little alcohol?
Yeah, a little bit of alcohol, and this was actually surprising to me in reporting this piece, is anything below the recommended daily limits that's set by the, I want to say the Food and Drug Administration, that is wrong, by the USDA. Mm. So I think normally when people hear about the health consequences of alcohol, we assume that that means excessive alcohol consumption, a lot of alcohol, maybe someone who has an alcohol use disorder is, you know, dependent on alcohol. And really what the recent research is showing is that anything above the recommended daily limits, which is one drink a day for women and two drinks a day for men, can actually start to negatively impact your health.
Mm. And even within that, didn't you find that it can also have negative impacts?
It can. There is some mounting research that the risk for some cancers, specifically esophageal cancer and breast cancer, start to go up even within those recommended limits, as well as the risk for heart disease, particularly with increasing blood pressure.
Hmm. So why is alcohol so harmful, even in small amounts?
Alcohol, when you drink alcohol, your liver metabolizes it into a chemical called acetaldehyde. And acetaldehyde is really, really damaging to the DNA in our cells. So it damages the DNA, and then it also prevents the DNA from repairing itself. And that's how it can start to lead to tumors. For breast cancer specifically, alcohol increases the amounts of estrogen, which is linked to breast cancer. And another form of DNA damage can occur called oxidative stress. And that is really harmful for the cells that line the blood vessels in our heart. And so all of these types of damage really mount up to make alcohol pretty damaging for our health long term.
Yeah, there was that also really striking November JAMA study that found that 140,000 deaths a year in the U.S. are related to alcohol. I guess one of the things that was even more surprising to me was that the majority of those deaths were caused by chronic conditions attributed to alcohol.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was really the impetus for me writing this recent article, was just kind of how shocking that study was from the CDC. Like you said, 140,000 deaths a year attributed to alcohol. About 40% of those are from acute deaths. So people who are intoxicated and maybe have a car accident or a drowning or even violence or a homicide. But like you said, about 60% are due to chronic conditions. So it's really showing that even just a little bit, you know, every day kind of built up over time can really take a really damaging effect on our health. The number one cause of those chronic conditions was alcoholic liver disease. That was about 20,000 deaths a year. And then cancer and heart diseases were also up there with, you know, a lot of alcohol related deaths, unfortunately.
Yeah. And that CDC study in JAMA also talked about how it was working age Americans who struggled with this the most, like Americans aged 20 to 64.
Right. A lot of these conditions we think of as, you know, affecting us when we get older, you know, after we're 60 or 70. But we start to see the effects of alcohol consumption pretty early on, you know, especially in people who are drinking, you know, well over those recommended limits, that, you know, even in your 20s and especially your 30s and 40s, you know, there are thousands of deaths a year in people those ages from alcohol.
So how is it then, given all of this, that we had study results from like the 90s that said alcohol was good for you in small amounts?
Yeah, it's been really confusing. You know, there's a lot of flip-flopping, and this happens a lot in any diet research, to be frank. You know, any, you know, we've all seen headlines about coffee saying it's good for us, it's bad for us. Same thing with eggs. You know, it's just really hard to do a large observational study to get meaningful data on something that is so common. So I think the current consensus is that the thought that alcohol was beneficial for us, that it was healthy for our hearts, was really an artifact in the data. So, you know, they conduct these studies by having, you know, thousands and thousands of people, asking them how much they drink, and then looking at their health consequences later in life. And generally, it was found that people who drink a little bit of alcohol, you know, within those recommended limits, tended to live longer and seemed to be healthier than people who didn't drink at all. So, you know, a lot of alcohol manufacturers and, you know, the rest of the public kind of jumped on that, thinking, oh, great, you know, one glass of wine or one beer a night is actually healthy for me. You know, I can justify this habit. And what researchers now think, they've been able to do a little bit more rigorous research design where they're randomizing people based on their genetics. So it's a new type of research study that has come out in the last couple of years that we think is a little bit more accurate. So we're looking at how much people drink, but we're randomizing them not based on how much they actually drink, but based on what their genes say they likely drink. And from that, we can see that even a little bit of alcohol is actually bad for people's health. It's no longer thought to be beneficial. It's actually causing damage potentially, or, you know, increasing blood pressure related to heart disease. And what the consensus now is that in those early studies, it was actually other healthy lifestyle behaviors that people had that were kind of masking the effect of alcohol. Or people who drink a little bit are more likely to exercise, they're less likely to smoke, they're more likely to eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. And actually those other healthy habits were what were improving their health, not the alcohol.
Well, there was a piece of good news in your article that when people stop drinking, even just a little bit, that it can have some significant positive impacts.
Absolutely. There is research out of Australia that women who, it's one of the few studies that I've seen recently that actually, you know, tested the amount of alcohol people drink, you know, ask people to drink a lot, to drink a little bit, and then to not drink at all. And you can see that even cutting back from a moderate amount of alcohol to a low amount was beneficial. You know, their blood pressure dropped. And there's research out of the UK that people who participate in Dry January, who stop drinking for a month, they have weight loss, they have better sleep, their blood pressure goes down. So we really start to see the benefits of cutting back or abstaining pretty dramatically and pretty quickly.
Yeah. How helpful is taking a whole month off, like a Dry January? You say that it has these great potential impacts on blood pressure and so on. But it sounds like
you know, the fear that you'll be craving that drink and dying for one come February isn't necessarily the case.
Yeah, I think this was really heartening. Again, in the UK, they looked at people who had participated in a dry January and then followed them for about 6 months afterwards. And they found that, you know, even though most people started drinking again, they drank less than they did before. So instead of drinking 4 days a week, they drank 3 days a week, and they drank a little bit less on each occasion. So it looks like the benefits of doing a dry January makes you really kind of reassess your relationship to alcohol, maybe see that you don't need it quite as much as you thought you did. And so you can cut back for the rest of the year. And that, so-called rebound effect that you mentioned only happened in about 10% of people. And those are people who really drank a lot before the dry January. And so they might've actually had an alcohol problem or an alcohol use disorder. So it was, only about 10% of people who took part in dry January had that rebound where they really seemed to be craving a drink at the end of it. But for most people, it seemed to improve their health kind of the rest of the year.
Well, let me ask our listeners if they've been doing dry January, and are you experiencing some of the benefits that Dana has been talking about with regard to abstaining for a month? You can reach Forum by emailing forum@kqed.org, posting Twitter, Facebook, Instagram @KQED Forum, or by calling 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. What effects have you noticed by cutting back on alcohol? Do you think you'll keep abstaining or cutting back if you did dry January beyond this month? And through this process, I am curious what you did find hardest or what situations were hardest not to drink. One of the things that I also was struck by, Dana, is that none of the experts you spoke to called for abstaining completely, unless maybe you do have an alcohol use disorder or other condition.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. You know, I wanted to ask all the experts about that, you know, given that the risk can start to increase even at small amounts, you know, should we just not drink at all? And even Dr. George Koob, who's the director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, said, frankly, no. You know, there are people who should not drink, women who are pregnant and people who have a problem with alcohol. But for most of us, just staying within those recommended daily limits is okay. You know, your risk can go up a little bit, but it's not going up a huge amount. And, you know, for some of these cancers, for example, the risk of you developing esophageal cancer is very low overall. So a small increase in your risk does not mean that you're actually going to get the condition, the disease. It's actually still a low risk overall. You know, Dr. Koob said this great thing that, you know, we've tried prohibition and it didn't work. So, you know, we're not going to outlaw alcohol. No one's saying that you have to stop drinking completely, but just be more aware of it and try to cut back a little bit, and you can actually have a lot of benefits for your health.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's this idea that, you know, ultimately the cost benefit of telling somebody to abstain, which feels like feel like a really hard thing, especially in our culture where it is so much a part of the way that we interact in this country in a lot of ways, that can actually encourage and inspire more people to cut back. I do want to ask you one thing that I understand, which is that you waited to release your piece, Even a Little Alcohol Can Harm Your Health, until after the holidays. What was behind that? We just have 30 seconds.
That's true. We initially thought about running it, you know, the initial study, the JAMA paper that you mentioned, came out in November. So we thought about running it around the holidays when people do have an uptick in their drinking. We ultimately decided to hold it until January when people are going through dry January. But a colleague of mine on the Well desk at the New York Times, Danny Bloom, had a great article in December about heart health. There's a condition called holiday heart that doctors know happens around Christmas time when people increase their alcohol intake, and they can actually lead to atrial fibrillation, another heart condition linked to alcohol.
Well, Dana, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dana Smith of the New York Times on alcohol. Stay with us. We'll have more after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Here's what we're talking about tomorrow, the mass shooting at a Monterey Park ballroom. What should have been a weekend of joy and celebration for the Monterey Park community turned into a massacre that claimed 10 lives and wounded 10 more. We learn about the victims and hear from you. How are you absorbing the tragedy? What questions or concerns is it bringing up for you? You can leave a voicemail at 415-553-3300. Or you can email forum at kqed.org. Today, we're looking at how even small reductions in the way we consume alcohol can have big benefits. And we were joined earlier by Dana Smith, whose piece, Even a Little Alcohol Can Harm Your Health, inspired today's segment. And we asked you, our listeners, to tell us, have you been trying those small reductions or even doing Dry January? If you've been doing Dry January, how's it going? What effects have you noticed? Do you think you'll keep abstaining or cutting back beyond January? What were some of the hardest situations to cut back? You can email forum at kqed.org, find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum. Call us at 866-733-6786. And some of you, our listeners, have already been writing in. Donna writes, my Dry January is going very well. I am sleeping so much better. BJ writes, one day at a time, I am 11,081 days sober, 30 years, 4 months, 2 days, but who's counting? That's awesome, BJ. I'm going to bring into the conversation now Keith Humphreys, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford School of Medicine. Keith Humphreys, thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Also, Taweed Zaman is with us, associate professor of psychiatry who leads the addiction psychiatry training program at UCSF. Taweed Zaman, glad to have you on as well.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So Keith, I want to start with you because I actually was struck by the fact that you have advised a charity that is credited with starting Dry January. And just before the break, we were talking with Dana about the benefits of it. Can you talk a little bit about your takeaways and your thoughts about how it has really taken off?
Yeah, sure. So I do a lot of work in Great Britain, and this is where Dry January really took off with different charities like Alcohol Health Alliance, which I've advised over the years. And it was particularly useful there. Britain is a heavy drinking society, and drinking is kind of made automatic. Almost everybody does it. You don't ever need a reason to drink. You need a reason to not drink. You have to, if you turn down a drink, they'll say, why aren't you drinking? And what Dry January does is it gives people a time out to just reestablish, is this something I actually want to do, that I want to make an automatic reflexive behavior that I don't think about? Or do I want to reflect on it and say, in the long term, do I want to be doing this every day or almost every day? And so I think it was perfectly matched to that culture. Ours is a bit different. We do have a lot of people who don't drink in America. We are a bit different than Europe. But nonetheless, we do have people here where it's automatic. You know, come home, flip on the TV and have a beer. And, if you get into that habit any given day, it doesn't do anything. But over a year or 2 years or 5 years, it can have an effect on your health. So you might want to, think it through. And Dry January is a good time to do that.
Mm. Well, let me go to caller Alana in Berkeley. Hi, Alana.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to share some Dry January experience in the past where I completely abstained. And it was, of course, very successful. I enjoyed a lot of the benefits that you've been discussing, better sleep, weight loss. But it is also limiting, obviously. And what I decided to do this year that's a little different is I just decided that I wasn't going to drink at home, that I wasn't going to drink to relax at the end of the day, but rather I was going to drink for joy and when I was experiencing a joyous occasion with friends. Mm. And that's really just cut down my alcohol use so significantly that I've had a total of, 3 alcoholic drinks in this month so far. They were all, away from home, celebrating, a friend's birthday or, a rare date night with my husband. And I've lost 7 pounds. I still feel great. You know, that it, maybe it doesn't have to be all or nothing, you know. But I think that this is the sort of lifestyle I might be able to keep up. And maybe just not having that drink at home is what could be helpful to people who, you know, were moderate drinkers and are wanting to drink even less than that.
Mm. Thanks for sharing that. Keith Humphreys, I'd love to get your thoughts on what Alana just said in terms of the benefits of a dry-ish January and also how Alana thought about drinking for joy.
Yeah, I love it. You know, I love the fact that Alana worked out consciously what works for her and what maximizes her well-being, and clearly it's working. And if Dry January does that for people, that's terrific. The ambition is not at all to convert people into lifetime abstainers unless they decide in their month that that's what they've concluded. But making, you know, careful decisions about when and where and when do I like it and when it's just something I'm doing automatically that I'm going to regret later, that to me is a great use of this month.
Mm. And Dr. Tawid-Zaman, the benefits, the health impacts of even a dry-ish January are still significant?
They really are. We know that there is a dose-dependent relationship between alcohol and so many different health outcomes. So that means the lower the dose of alcohol someone is taking in over time, the less likely they might be to develop any of those conditions that we talked about. So everything from the cardiac illnesses like hypertension, health failure, stroke, all of the cancers that Dana mentioned, and certainly liver disease, all of those have a dose-dependent relationship with alcohol. So I'm a huge supporter of folks cutting down as much as they're able.
One of the studies that Dana talked about found that about 10%, I guess, ended up kind of making up for lost time, and people drank even more in the following month. What does that indicate, Dr. Zaman?
The fact that such a large number of people were actually able to continue to abstain is actually what's most surprising to me. And so I think that many people, you know, do experience this reset of their relationship with alcohol. I think Dry January really is an opportunity for someone to kind of step back and to think about, okay, am I kind of using alcohol in a way that I don't really like? You know, am I using it to cope with certain feelings or cope with certain situations? Is it becoming a bit of a crutch? Or is it causing some actual difficulties in my life? You know, so we know that the kind of most basic definition of an addiction is use despite consequences. And so if someone is drinking and it makes them feel sick or harms their relationship or affects their ability to work or go to school, et cetera, then they might have a problem. So for me, it's really remarkable that people are able to use this month and really kind of reflect in that way. And that actually is a surprising number of people are able to maintain it kind of throughout the year.
Yeah. Keith, do you want to say a word about Americans on the whole drinking a lot more in the last few years? There have been some studies that have borne that out.
Yes, that's right. Even though we do have more people than most countries probably do, to the fact that we're a more religious country, who have never drank at all, American consumption overall is actually gone up pretty high. It's higher than it's been in over 20 years, probably because alcohol is much cheaper than it used to be. You know, taxes have declined in terms of inflation. And as like any other commodity, as it gets more affordable, people consume it more. There's also been quite a bit of effort by the industry to market to women. So sort of, you know, wine mom culture was an industry creation because they realized women were getting more disposable income and they weren't drinking as much. So how do you make money for that? You kind of gin up, and no pun intended, you gin up a culture around, you know, this is what it means to be a modern woman, have your mommy juice and all that. And that also accelerated drinking. So the increases have been much higher among women than among men in the last 20 years.
Hmm. Well, let me go to John in San Francisco. Hi, John, you're on.
Good morning. It's a great program. When I quit drinking, it was $1 for a highball. Now it's $10. So where does this guy say it's cheaper to drink today? I don't think so. I'm sober for 40 years, and my three daughters are in AA. I started off trying to, you know, to be off alcohol for a month. Went to the Catholic Church. They had what they call a pledge card in the Catholic Church, and that lasted for 30 days, maybe. in the next month, I more than made up for it. Mm. And it went on like that for 7 years until I lost just about everything. Unemployable. My health was deteriorating. When I went to the hospital for rehabilitation, I had what they call pre-cirrhosis. The doctor said, your body may heal the pre-cirrhosis. It may not. Fortunately, it did. And now I have 41 years clean and sober, and my health is great. I'm 85 years old, and my experience, and I go to an AA meeting every day. This morning I went there. We had young girls there with the same, you know, talking about drinking alcohol in small amounts and needing it and not being able to quit.
You know, John, that's such an interesting point. And thank you so much for sharing your story. And I'm so glad to hear that you were able to recover, especially liver disease. As we know, Dr. Zaman, is something that once it reaches a certain point can be no turning back, really. But I guess one of the things that I am wondering is, you know, based on what John's describing and what he just said about people having small amounts but feeling like they need it, how do you evaluate if this might be you or if you're bordering or have an alcohol use disorder?
Mm-hmm. I think that's an excellent question. And I think knowing family history can actually be really powerful in those cases. So often, in addition to talking to someone about their experiences and kind of the ways they're using alcohol in their lives and whether it's getting in the way, I think it's really helpful to know a family history of alcohol or other substance use disorders, because we know that this can partly be a genetic condition. So someone might be at more risk if it runs in their family. So often I'll talk to them about kind of the ways that alcohol is affecting them. I'll talk about their family history. And then one of the things that can be a bit more invisible, for lack of a better word, I guess, for folks long term, are some of the risks of those chronic illnesses. So for example, I will work with people to look at their blood pressure or their blood sugar or their weight and think about the relationship between alcohol and those conditions, because those might be chronic issues that someone may not notice day to day, but certainly could have long-term consequences. So I think it's kind of important to look at the entire picture there.
Mm. We're talking with Dr. Tawhid Zaman, Associate Professor of Psychiatry, who leads the Addiction Psychiatry Training Program at UCSF and Director of the Addiction Consult and Opioid Safety San Francisco VA Medical Center is where Dr. Zaman does that. Dr. Keith Humphreys is a Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford School of Medicine, also author of the forthcoming book, Addiction, A Very Short Introduction. And we are also talking with you, our listeners, about your relationship with alcohol. If you've been cutting back on drinking and noticed any benefits, maybe you've been doing dry January. 866-733-6786 is the number. Email address forum@kqed.org. Post thoughts on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram @KQED Forum. Kelly writes on Instagram, haven't had a drink in over 5.5 years, so my dry January is going great. Yay, Kelly. You know, Dr. Zaman, though, you have also written a piece, though, about people who may experience withdrawal if they try something like abstaining completely for a month. What is alcohol withdrawal syndrome, and what should you be on the lookout for if you might be a candidate for experiencing that?
Absolutely. I think it's good for people to be aware of alcohol withdrawal. I do want to mention that really for the vast majority of people, dry January and abstinence more generally is not very risky. In fact, it's likely to be much more beneficial for all the reasons we've kind of discussed. But my piece was really focused on the risks for people who are daily drinkers or nearly daily drinkers. And those are the people who we think might be physiologically dependent on alcohol. And as a result of that, particularly in the first 7 to 10 days after someone who drinks daily kind of stops drinking or cuts down significantly, they can experience alcohol withdrawal. And those symptoms really have a broad range. So they might be mild symptoms, which really are mostly uncomfortable and relatively not medically dangerous. But some people, you know, the minority of people can progress to have moderate or severe symptoms of alcohol withdrawal. And as a physician, I think that's where I really start to worry, because severe symptoms can actually include seizures, it can include delirium tremens or DTs, which folks may have heard of, and those are actually kind of life-threatening conditions that someone might need to be in the hospital for. So That said, I think particularly for folks who drink daily, it's important to know that these are also treatable conditions. And that's why I want people to really talk to their doctor about that. And overall, I really believe that the risks of withdrawal should not keep the vast majority of people from abstaining.
Treatable how? You mean with medications?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, we certainly even mild symptoms, which are uncomfortable, can be treated with medications, you know, and these can be short-term medications just to even help get through those first 7 to 10 days. And then the more severe symptoms like seizures and delirium tremens, those often require kind of medications which are kind of heavy duty and require more monitoring. So someone might end up spending a bit of time in the ED or, you know, even be admitted overnight just to kind of help keep them safe. But that evaluation really depends on the person and how their particular withdrawal syndrome is progressing.
Well, Stephanie writes, this is my fourth year in a row, sixth overall, doing Sober January. One year I went for 6 months, another year 7 months, and occasionally I take regular breaks during other months too. My skin clears up, I lose weight, I have more energy and sleep great. I save money and I don't have brain fog. For all the benefits, you would think I would just continue to stay sober. But the hardest part is always the social aspect. For people thinking about quitting, I highly recommend checking out the Stop Drinking subreddit for a great community in the book This Naked Mind by Annie Grace. Keith Humphries, I gotta say, that is something that I hear a lot, is the social piece is probably the hardest situation to not drink in. What do you suggest around that for people who want to try to, you know, still be social but not have that pressure?
Yeah. I mean, I think also we can ask, what can we all do to not apply that pressure?
Yeah.
You know, it's a very interesting thing. If you go to a party and say, do you want to drink? And someone says no, you say, oh, why not? Why aren't you drinking? Which is funny because we don't ask an explanation for why is somebody drinking? And, you know, we could all just stop doing that. It's really uncomfortable for people in recovery or people who have illnesses or maybe people it's a faith commitment. They don't particularly want to, you know, talk about off the top of their head with everyone they meet. So just accepting that, I think we could all support each other that way for sure. You know, and everyone is going to develop, I think, their own strategy of how they handle this. And I think it's just important to realize it's okay. It's your health. Ultimately, you are the one who will bear most of the consequences of that decision. So it's absolutely fine to say, you know, because I don't feel like it, or I would just rather not, and not have to elaborate and not have to apologize in any way for not wanting to drink. It really shouldn't be a big issue. I can say this is one thing that is actually good about today's young people who are often dumped on is teenagers, for example. No, they really are. I mean, you know, kids these days are drinking way less than their parents.
Yeah.
That's something to know about kids these days. And I see that like in college, you know, I'm on a university campus. Every campus in this country has some problem drinking. But the young people coming in are more okay with the thought that they don't drink and they just say it and they're cool with it. And that's something, speaking as a parent, I find very encouraging.
Yeah, I love that reminder of the things that we can do not to pressure people. And Dr. Zaman, we're coming up on a break, but if you just have any thoughts about strategizing around social pressures to drink.
Absolutely. I mean, I would agree with Dr. Humphries that people don't really owe anyone any explanation for their abstinence, but I tell people to kind of disclose what works for them. So some people just say, I'm doing dry January. Others kind of put it on me. You know, they say, my doctor prescribed me a medication that doesn't really mix with alcohol, or, you know, I'm trying to lose weight. And some people say nothing at all. So I think the message is, it's your life and your health. So kind of share the reason that feels right to you.
Yeah. Listeners, if you have management strategies or ways that you have a relationship with alcohol that you feel is healthy, we'd love to hear about it. 866-733-6786, the number to call. Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum is how you can reach us there. Email address forum@kqed.org. A listener writes, I've recently gotten a car and appreciate that driving gives me an easy out from drinking when out with friends at a bar. It can be hard to say no otherwise, especially if a friend buys a drink for me before I get there. More after the break. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. After decades of confusing research suggesting too much alcohol is bad for you, but a little bit is good, it appears doctors and scientists are coalescing around the finding that even a small amount of drinking can have health impacts. We're talking about why alcohol can be so harmful, what can be done about it during a month that many try to abstain, or Dry January. David writes, "I wasn't a heavy drinker, but I was a regular drinker until this New Year's Day. On that day, I started a Dry January with the intention of making it a dry life. I noticed that my craving for alcohol has steadily diminished as the month has progressed. I now hardly ever think about drinking. I find it very useful to substitute something for alcoholic beverages. Sometimes this has been herbal tea, taken in the evening when I'm trying to relax at the end of my day, when I used to have a drink of vodka." Let me go to caller Fred in San Jose. Hi, Fred. You're on.
Thank you. I drink only about one glass of wine a week. As a result of listening to this program, I've made up my mind to abstain completely. Hmm. What I find peculiar is that the doctors involved in this study apparently are not advocating abstaining. And I wonder why that is.
Huh. Thanks, Fred. Keith Humphreys, your thoughts on that. It's true. No one that Dana talked to, the reporter we had on at the top, recommended abstaining.
Yeah, well, it's risk information, right? You know, that's what you do with public health guidelines. We tell people, you know, this is more risky than that, or, you know, wear your seatbelt and, you know, exercise and all that sort of thing. But we try not to make completely dichotomous recommendations, like your choices are abstinence or disaster, because that's not really true. And also because that's pretty demoralizing to people. So it's more useful advice to say, well, if you can drink less, you're going to be healthier. It's not that anyone opposes abstinence in medicine at all. It's just that insisting on it relative to all the other risks is not a great a public health strategy any more than it would be to say, okay, for weight loss, everybody needs to look like a supermodel, you know, or otherwise you're not healthy. That's not real life.
Hmm. Well, this listener writes, given the longer lives of moderate drinkers due to healthy lifestyles, can one say a healthy lifestyle sufficiently mitigates the effects of alcohol? Dr. Zaman, wondering about that, or are there other things that people need to consider?
I think that's a really great question. I think kind of what adds kind of years of life, and particularly good quality years of life, I think is a really complex question. I do think that for folks who are thinking about kind of the effects of alcohol that were shown early, kind of in the studies that you referenced about being kind of cardioprotective, you know, we think that multiple things might have confounded those studies. So kind of the, you know, it might have been exercise, it might have been access to better healthcare, all kinds of things. But I guess I would say for those people, yes, for some people, it may kind of ameliorate the risks of alcohol longer term, but we don't actually exactly know what all of those factors are, though we suspect some of them. And part of the reason is these are hard things to study. So there have not been great randomized controlled trials, which, you know, really involves comparing people who drink, you know, drink any amount at all to people who don't drink, and kind of looking at the actual impact that alcohol versus abstinence has on kind of lifespan. We're not able to quantify that. So I can't provide kind of an evidence-based answer on how much, you know, for example, exercise or nutrition might balance out the harmful effects of alcohol. So I would say it's not been well studied, and I would just, you know, continue to practice all the healthy habits, but part of that could also involve drinking less.
Well, this listener tweets, "I did Dry January last year, enjoying a fancy seltzer
with adaptogens and CBD instead. This year, I decided I didn't need to abstain, having limited my drinking to one or two evenings a week. I absolutely agree that sleep is better without booze. Dr. Zaman, about balancing it out. So if you say you don't drink during the week, you change your habits so that you only drink on the weekends, but you allow yourself, you know, more than the USRDA, right? Like two or three or more on a Friday, Saturday night or something like that. Is mm-hmm. that better for you than, say, doing it regularly?
Mm-hmm. It can be, you know, and I think we as a field have moved away from kind of abstinence and embraced harm reduction for exactly this reason. So, you know, it might be really reasonable for someone to take that harm reduction approach and say, you know, actually, if I drink on the weekends, even if it's a bit more than kind of the recommended guidelines, you know, it doesn't have as much of an impact on my functioning or my life. You know, say I'm, you know, someone who's working during the week or, you know, going to school, things like that, you know, it has less of an impact on my functioning. I think that's a very reasonable harm reduction approach to take with the majority of folks. And it can look a little bit different for every single person, right? So I think anything that people can do to reduce the impact of alcohol on their life really should be investigated.
Yeah. But that said, my understanding is that the amount of alcohol in your system at any given time, if it's significant, can cause damage, right?
Absolutely, yes. So because of the toxic effects of not just alcohol, but acetaldehyde, which we talked about earlier, the presence of those substances in the system can do some amount of damage. So absolutely.
Let me go to Amit next. Hi, Amit. You're on.
Yes, I just wanted to compliment the show. I've heard about this dry January earlier, I mean in December, sometimes on NPR, I think, and I made up my mind to go ahead with it. One thing, this is my 23rd day, obviously, and one thing I mentioned that I used to drink heavy end, like high end scotch and such, and when I started it, I started craving, but I actually noticed that I was craving for a taste of alcohol, as in like a beer or something, rather than the scotch whiskey itself. So I went to the supermarket, Trader Joe's has some good collection of non-alcoholic beers, and I got some of that, and it turns out that I actually crave the taste of it rather than the effect of it. So occasionally I have non-alcoholic beer every now and then, and that just does it for me. So something I wanted to share. Thank you.
Yeah, glad to hear that. And again, this opportunity to kind of really understand what is it about our alcohol consumption, Keith Humphreys, that makes us turn to it at times. You have touched on the cultural shifts that we're seeing, that a younger generation is drinking less than previous generations and so on. I'm wondering what other changes you are noticing with regard to reduction. Like we're hearing that people are, you know, sober curious groups and so on are taking off. We're hearing about more and more variety available in stores that are like the same thing. What has stood out to you in terms of a cultural shift?
I see a real split, actually, in the population. So you have younger people, teenagers, early college students, much more comfortable not drinking at all. And then when we have the midlife and late midlife group, we have some of the highest drinking we've ever seen. So there's those deaths that you mentioned earlier and Dana mentioned earlier, and deaths of despair. I think many people have heard that term, and we see that going up and up, and particularly in midlife. And so it's almost like there's less of a middle than there used to be in America in how we handle alcohol. And for that reason, I'm really glad to see so many callers being very flexible in how they think about this. There are people who have very serious drinking problems who really do need to stop forever. And then there are lots and lots of other people who may drink a bit too much, but you would never say in the old parlance, that's alcoholism. You would say, oh, you're just drinking to a point that's harming your health, and you can cut back a bit and still drink, and that's okay. You'll be healthier. And we need to keep that flexibility because we've got very different kinds of patterns of drinking around the country and across generations.
So let me ask you then, what are some of the conditions that set people up for success if they are going to try cutting back significantly or abstaining, Keith?
So we know a lot about this. So people who are the most likely who drink a lot are likely to succeed at moderate drinking are people who don't have co-occurring serious mental health problems, people who have a job and some kind of social stability, stable relationship, people have an education, all more likely to succeed in becoming moderate drinkers, and also people who can find a social network that will support them. And the abstinence end, everybody knows AA certainly works, but there's plenty of other social groupings where, organized around health. If you join a regular jogging group, if you join a church group, a singing group, something where drinking is not part of it, and that's fun and enjoyable, and you feel happy and you get connection away from alcohol, that's going to make it easier for you to use alcohol less or to quit entirely than it will if you just kind of try to white knuckle it through, give up something that you enjoy, but not get any rewards in return.
Yeah. Karen writes, after years of overindulging, I decided to do dry January. So glad I did. I don't think I'll go back to my former habits. My sleep has improved. Anxiety is going down. I've lost 5 pounds and my resting heart rate has gone down. As a caller just said, I think I will only drink occasionally when enjoying an evening out and be much more mindful about it. Still trying to find more evening beverages I enjoy. Certainly we're hearing from listeners that finding a new favorite drink is a very helpful thing. Keith, I just want to ask you, and if it's okay to ask you this personal question, do you drink and how you manage it?
Yeah, I do drink. But ever since I started advising those charities, I also do dry January. And I'll be honest, we went on vacation over New Year's Eve. So I started my dry January late and I will continue it into February a week to make up for that. What I find is the main effect of me is I tend to lose a little weight, like 2 or 3 pounds. And I tried to figure out how that could be, because certainly there's calories and alcohol, but not enough to account for that. And I realized what it was is that if you put a double fudge sundae in front of me and say, would you like this? I will say, I don't think so. I always need to watch my weight. But if I had a glass of wine, I'll say, sure. So, alcohol then becomes a trigger to sort of drop my self-control enough that then I'll eat more than I should. And maybe then the next day, do I really feel like getting up early to do my walking or exercising? And I don't. So, for me, it's useful taking off those few pounds and also just regenerating those other health behaviors, making sure I keep consistent to them.
Yeah. I read a tip, too, that said, savor that glass of wine, meaning enjoy your drink in a way that you'll feel satisfied after just one, perhaps.
That's good advice.
Again, Keith Humphries is professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford School of Medicine. Tahid Zaman is associate professor of psychiatry and leads the addiction psychiatry training program at UC San Francisco. And you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. So Stan writes, so no amount of alcohol is healthy, but it's healthy to drink within the limits of the federal guidelines. Which is it? Dr. Zaman, Stan wants something a little more clear, I think. Do you have a way to answer Stan's question? Because, yeah, what we are finding is that those RDA, the recommended daily guidelines of 1 drink a day for women, 2 drinks for men, are still out there.
They are out there. I mean, it really kind of depends on the data that you look at in some ways, right? Because if you look at the guidelines, I think one incorrect way to interpret that data or those guidelines is to say that, well, if I'm staying within those limits, then I'm safe because, that number of drinks is safe for everyone. But we also know from kind of large global studies that even a little bit of alcohol is associated with an increase in all-cause mortality. So that has been borne out in, studies that looked at alcohol across 195 countries. So what I would say is this, any amount of alcohol can be risky to the right person. So I think someone really needs to consider their particular risks. So if someone has a history of addiction personally or in their family, if they're at risk for heart disease or cancer, if they have a history of problems with alcohol earlier in life, and issues like, DUIs or other kind of real consequences, Well, for a lot of those people, actually 0 might be, the safe level of alcohol to drink. But I think most people fall somewhere in between.
Do you agree with the nationwide call that Canada, for example, the Canadian Center on Substance Abuse and Addiction, said the safest amount of alcohol to drink is none, which is a significant shift from its previous guidance.
That actually is true. And that is actually something I talk to my patients about, you know, during our visits. And now, of course, I'm not advocating abstinence for everyone all the time. And I don't kind of enforce that with my patients. But I think, you know, as a physician, I want people to have the information, and I do want them to know that the safest amount is zero, you know, and that can apply to not just alcohol, to, you know, but to really just about any other substance. So in that sense, it's really not that much of a surprise.
Well, Christy writes, I think it would be beneficial to talk about mental health support and how available it is if people are having trouble reducing their alcohol consumption. Trauma can significantly affect alcohol consumption, and many people self-medicate instead of seeking mental health help. I was talking earlier, Dr. Zaman, with Keith about structural changes, but I guess the question I have is, like, is the medical system changing? Are doctors doing a good job of talking about this with their patients, for example, and also in terms of just the kind of structural supports around mental health that is needed that Christy brings up?
I think there's a long way to go, but there are many reasons to be optimistic. So it's helpful to know that even though addiction psychiatry as a specialty has been around for a long time, and so has addiction medicine actually became its own kind of recognized, accredited medical specialty in the last few years. And I think that really reflects a broader kind of understanding in the medical community that, yes, you know, substance use disorder treatment is something that is worth doing and specializing in. And more hospitals and universities have addiction kind of experts who can help people who have severe addictions. But I think very importantly, I think most people don't know, including some doctors, don't know that there are actually three FDA-approved medications which can help people drink less or not at all. And these medications are not new. They've been around for decades, you know, and they're naltrexone, acamprosate, and disulfiram. Those are the three that are FDA-approved. And the reason, you know, people don't hear about them or kind of get access to them is that I think most people have not heard of them, and their physicians may not think about it. But I encourage people to ask their doctors about that. And it does not have to be an addiction specialist like me. You know, there are more people in my field kind of prescribing these medications, but any physician is actually able to prescribe them. So that's the other piece that I think is important, that I think more and more general internal medicine doctors, primary care doctors, are getting comfortable prescribing some of those medications, which can also be a tool for someone trying to cut back or stop.
Well, Jill writes, this is my fourth year. The first year was hell. I guess this is doing dry January. I felt so bad with headaches and just flu-like symptoms. I consider myself a high-functioning alcoholic. This past year, I worked on not drinking 2 days a week, and we'll try to increase that to 3 to 4 days. The 2 days alcohol-free has helped tremendously to get through January. I find that I do drink more when around friends, so I bring non-alcoholic drinks to have after one or two glasses. I belong to a dry January Facebook group, and it's nice to give and get helpful ideas. I think this really underscores our discussion today. But Keith, any reactions to what Jill just wrote there?
No, that's terrific. This and so wise to seek the support of others trying to do the same thing is a really good way. Any health behavior change, having other people, you know, walking alongside us makes it easier.
Yeah. Donna writes, I had a dry October. The great part was that I considered that I didn't miss alcohol. I was able to consider behavior and habits and have a discussion with my family about those habits. I still drink, though a smaller amount and not daily. Well, Keith Humphreys, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, Keith Humphreys' forthcoming book, Addiction, A Very Short Introduction. Dr. Tawhid Zaman, thank you as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Associate Professor of Psychiatry and leads the Addiction Psychiatry Training Program at UCSF. Thank you, listeners, for sharing your victories, your hardships, and your questions. Thank you, Caroline Smith, for producing today's segment. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.